This year, experience the NHL playoffs your way. Want to watch a single? Do or die Game 7, a full week of heavy-hitting back-and-forth series. Then check out Sling's 1, 3, and 7-day passes. Watch the Chase for the Cup on ESPN and TNT, starting as low as $4.99. No long-term contracts or overpaying. Just live hockey at home or when you want it. Sling lets you do that. Visit sling.com to learn more.
I don't think that we can allow Iran to have a chokehold over the international economy and the Gulf. Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, and a Bulwark contributor. I'm joined by my partner in all things strategery, Elliot Cohen, professor emeritus of strategy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and an Atlantic contributing writer. Elliot, how are you on this somewhat chilly Friday? It hasn't been quite as warm as advertised, at least where I'm sitting.
Well, I like it. I wish it was like cold and wet and rainy with high winds, but that's because I'm from Boston. But actually, it's really nice. We've been looking at our freshly planted garden, and the consultant who helped put it in said, "Don't worry, once you get a week's worth of warm weather, that thing's going to explode." So listen, we have a very large agenda today. I'm going to begin for our jackassery segment, except this time I'm going to begin not with jackassery, but this is really more of the useful idiot award. And my target today is Nick Kristof, who wrote an article in the New York Times, which is this long and quite ferocious indictment of sexual crimes committed by the Israel Defense Forces and their prison service. And this has aroused a bit of a furore. To be clear, I think everybody acknowledges there have been abuse of prisoners, including sexual abuse in Israeli prisons. The Israeli military itself has jailed people for that, as happens in American prisons, and as unfortunately has also happened and been kinds of things that have been committed by American soldiers, British soldiers, Canadian soldiers, and others. But he really makes it out to be something that is massive and a matter of policy. And he really is, does basically, in effect, says it's the equivalent of what happened on October 7th, in which, as an Israeli report that was released, the day after, he says the timing is a coincidence. That may be the case. I don't know. The October 7th was really systematic. The thing about his story, though, which has really caused outrage, interestingly, particularly on the Israeli center left, think about journalists like Haviv Redigor, are a number of things in it which are so problematic that useful idiot is the kindest thing one can say about it. There are two items in particular. First, the main human rights organization that he cites, most of his sources are unnamed, of course, is something called the EuroMed Human Rights Monitor, which is based in Switzerland. Now, what's interesting about this is it's founded, and its current chairman is a man named Rami Abdu, who the Israelis have long designated as a Hamas operative. There's a very good story in Free Press by Eli Lake about this, although there's also a very long article in Quillette and Haviv Redigor on X and his podcast. Also, the Wall Street Journal has covered it. So on October 8th, Rami Abdu posted the following on X. "In this battle, Palestine offered the elite of its youth and men on the path of freedom and dignity. Succeeding generations will remember you, and history will immortalize you as knightly heroes who forged for us a pure glory untainted by the mud. Preserve their names well and teach the tales of their immortal valor to your children and grandchildren." That's to the mob of murderers and rapists that Hamas unleashed on October 7th of 2023, killing over 1,200 people and committing really mass and systemic rape. The other thing is he had there's a story in there, which he does not source, certainly by name, that the Israelis have dogs trained to rape Palestinians. Now, there was a response from a lot of people saying that's not actually physically possible, including a whole bunch of statements by dog handlers. And he wrote back a kind of a snarky, not to say snotty, ex saying, well, this is documented in three medical journals, sigh, and I quote. When it turns out a number of doctors kind of began, he didn't say which journal articles they were, other people began digging them up. And they were all actually about bestiality. That is to say, where the humans were initiating things. And even those, you know, as the articles make clear, it's not even clear that these things actually happened. And the basic view of the dog handler seems to be, this just isn't really possible. And the thing that I guess that gets me about this is, you know, obviously the bad stuff has happened and Israelis know it and the best Israelis are anguished about it. But this goes way beyond that. And I find it particularly galling, I have to say, that the New York Times editorial page, which, if you remember, fired a bunch of people for the crime of tolerating a potential op-ed by Senator Tom Cotton, is just standing by this, standing by reporting, which is obviously deeply, deeply problematic. So, like I said, the nicest thing I'm going to call him is useful idiot. Over to you for some jackassery.
Well, just one quick comment on all of this. And I think it, you know, the point you made at the outset is crucial here. There have been cases of abuse of Palestinian prisoners by Israelis. There have been cases of abuse in Gaza by Israeli troops. There's been a terribly unsettling pattern of abuse of Palestinians in the West Bank by settlers. That is, you know, deeply troubling, I think, to people who support Israel or should be. The problem is, you know, when you get excesses like this that you've described, you know, poorly sourced, tendentious accounts, etc., it makes it all too easy for those who would like to whitewash all of that to do so by saying, you know, to paraphrase Ronald Reagan from his debate with Jimmy Carter, there you go again, you know, and wish it all away. And so, you know, the reality is bad enough that we have to confront from time to time, as you point out, Abu Ghraib, other things like that, without, you know, kind of inventing things that, you know, that that didn't happen. So much jackassery. You know, as we come on, the Justice Department is about to make a settlement with President Trump, even though he's on both sides of the transaction, to deal with the leak of his tax returns to the New York Times by a non-governmental contractor who's already serving jail time for what he did. And it's going to be he's going to drop his suit before a judge could throw it out. And they're going to create a Truth and Reconciliation Commission for anybody, quote unquote, you know, targeted by the weaponization of the Justice Department by the Biden administration. It's going to be a $1.7 billion fund to which Trump gets to appoint all the trustees, can remove them at will. There's no transparency on the process, how they're going to do this, who they're going to give the money to. That would be an easy target, or maybe Kash Patel, who took a snorkeling trip while on official travel to Hawaii around the USS Arizona, which is, I'm sure most of our listeners and viewers know, is hallowed ground after the attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941. That would be a great nominee. You know, I would point out the Wall Street Journal, I think maybe listening in on our podcast last week, ran a piece after we talked about the hollowing out of American diplomacy and the diplomatic service, pointed out that there are 100 crucial ambassadorships that have not yet had an appointee named by the administration, including in the Gulf and including Russia and Ukraine. But I prefer to defend one of our own colleagues and a friend of ours, Robert Karam, a senior aide to Senator Mitch McConnell, who now chairs the Appropriations Subcommittee on Defense. And President Trump singled out Robert for approaching McConnell in a hearing and whispering in his ear a screed on Truth Social about what a terrible person Robert is. He's a never-Trumper, approved by, you know, by Obama's people. Without
who
ever
actually served in the who served in the first Trump administration, let us point out.
Yeah, I mean, someone who served his own administration as Assistant Secretary for International Security Affairs in the Department of Defense, and for a long part of his service was actually acting undersecretary, the position I once held. A distinguished public servant who we've worked with over the years, both in the executive branch and in his congressional hats. It's absurd, and it's, you know, aimed at someone who is trying to remedy the mess that Trump has made of defense funding. I mean, McConnell is trying to get the Department of Defense additional resources that it does need. They have made a mess of this with dividing up the money in the budget, some of it in the base budget, some of it in the reconciliation package that they're trying to put together. There's no detail in it, so members of Congress, you know, don't know what they're voting for and whether it's actually going to the things that members of Congress rightly are concerned about. It's just, you know, it's unbelievable. And it's, I think, really symbolic of the broader mismanagement of the Department of Defense that has gone on in the Hegseth era. We've picked on Pete Hegseth a lot, you know, on Shield of the Republic, but what's going on is very serious business. The U.S. Army, Department of the Army, is about to run out of money, in part because of, you know, $5 or $6 billion that have been wasted on these National Guard deployments to major urban areas and sending troops to the border. NBC has reported that the department has been incapable of actually getting, you know, munitions that are sorely needed and that they keep whining about on contract. It's really just a terrible picture of gross mismanagement. And his attack on, you know, someone who's actually trying to fix the problem is just symptomatic of the disorder and chaos.
It is. Actually, I was, you've been on a writing streak this week. We'll talk about one of your pieces at the end of the show. But you had a wonderful piece, I thought, in the Dispatch, talking about the Reagan defense buildup, which I think is part of a separate effort with the Reagan Forum. And I think the thing that really comes through, and we should post it in the show notes, is this is what happens when you have a well-managed defense buildup, which, as you also point out, in many ways has its origins in the Carter years, and some very talented leadership by Harold Brown, Secretary of Defense, and William Perry, Undersecretary of Defense. And, you know, the fact is, as you, again, correctly point out, the U.S. military has been living off the Reagan buildup for 30 or 40 years now. And that's a problem, actually, because, you know, the basic items of equipment are now long in the tooth, and you can only modernize them or modify them so long. I mean, some of them you continue to produce, but you produce them with different modifications. So you're right. And it is, you know, we have dunked quite a bit on Pete Hegseth, but I think you're absolutely correct to call our attention to what happens when you have systemic, poor, incompetent management. Could we move on, unless there's something else you want to say about that, to Iran?
Yeah, well, Yes, we can move on. I just would, you know, point out that, as you said, Harold Brown, Bill Perry, did enormous service to the country by investing in some incredibly important capabilities. I quote Bill Perry in the piece himself as saying, "Yeah, we started to develop all these capabilities, precision guided munitions, stealth technology, but we had no idea, you know, where the money was going to come from to fund them. And it was only in the Reagan administration where the money was put to actually procuring these capabilities at scale, which, you know, allowed us to, as you say, you know, benefit from the buildup for some 40 years. Maybe one way to sort of segue from that into Iran is to talk about something that you were quoted on in the New York Times, which is the appropriate role of the chairman in briefing the president on these issues. So why don't you explain kind of what you said, and we can go from there, and then, you know, build out into the larger questions that, you know, face us with regard to the war.
Right. So there was a piece by Greg Jaffe, who's a very good journalist, who we both know at the New York Times, formerly at the Washington Post. And the issue was General Kane and how forthcoming or not forthcoming he's been in public about American strategy. And there was something which I thought was actually kind of a distraction. He said, you know, he hasn't been talking about the Iranian center of gravity. That's a term of art derived from Clausewitz, which I won't go into here. I think that's a bit of a distraction. And the question is, well, is that what he's supposed to be doing? Some people said yes, among them Heidi Urban, a retired Army colonel here in town. And I said no. My strong view actually is it's okay. The chairman has to respond to Congress. If Congress asks for his honest opinions and his honest assessments, he absolutely has to do that. I mean, this is that's the nature of our system of government. But do I think that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff should go around volunteering, our strategic concepts for fighting a war? First, I think it's imprudent in the middle of a war to say, yeah, we think the most important thing about Iran is, let's say, the top 100 leaders, because that does sort of tell the top 100 leaders that if the bombing starts, they really need to make themselves scarce or anything else of that kind. It's showing more of your hand than you absolutely have to. But in any case, it seems to me it is absolutely the responsibility of the civilian leadership to articulate those kinds of things in public. And until and they should not hide behind the military, which often what happens. Moreover, you know, when you talk about the higher direction of war, and here I really do follow Clausewitz, it's all about politics. Wars, you know, Clausewitz famously tells us is the use of military force to pursue the ends of policy. Which means, you know, it's fundamentally a political activity, and it rests on judgments which are, at least in large part, political. I mean, and are not actually necessarily in a general's area of expertise. You know, I don't expect the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff actually to be an expert on Iranian internal politics. So, you know, my strong view was Kane did the right thing, has done the right thing thus far by not divulging that. The exception I would make is if Congress asks him publicly or, you know, hopefully in closed session, then he has an absolute obligation to be forthcoming. What's your take?
So, you know, I get frequently asked whether I think General Kane has been, quote, speaking truth to power or telling the president, you know, what he needs to hear, you know, and particularly about risks. You know, a lot of people said, well, President said no one told him that the Iranians might close the strait. And my usual answer is I'm quite certain that General Kane has, whenever he's briefed the president, talked about whatever risks there are inherent in whatever they were talking about. And that one of the main risks that we have known about collectively, those of us who've been involved in government over the last 40 years, is that Iran might close the strait. And there's now whether the president heard it or not, that's a different, you know, different question. Where it starts to get a little kind of fuzzier, I think, is the issue of whether the president, whether there's a perception in the department that the chairman might be kind of shading things a little bit. And that's a broader question. It's not just about Kane briefing the president. It's about everything that we see going on in the department. And I worry a little bit that, you know, because the survival with President Trump requires you to, you know, sometimes either avoid the truth or, you know, walk your way around the truth, that there may be a perception that's brewing among officers, you know, I'm thinking 06s here, you know, colonels, people who are about to maybe become general officers, that the way to get ahead is to keep your head down and not necessarily be completely straight with everything. I don't think that's Kane's fault. I'm not laying blame with him. It's part of just the, you know, the miasma that's been created by Trump and his hyperbole and his inability to articulate what the, you know, objectives are, and his inability to understand that tactical accomplishments don't necessarily, it's not, you know, math. It doesn't add up to strategic achievement.
Yeah. So I mean, I may be in a slightly different place than you. I certainly acknowledge the miasma. And, you know, I don't think I'm guilty of paying too many compliments to Trump, although I may have a somewhat higher estimate of some things than you do, which we can discuss that a little bit later. But I think, you know, with Kane, I don't think it's fair to assume that he's not being completely candid with Trump. You don't know. You don't know. And if there's one problem that we've had, I think, in assessing all things Trump, it's the unwillingness of so many people to say, we really don't know. And you know, I think it's really problematic to, you know, assume the worst when you have no evidence whatsoever. And in this case, we just, there is no evidence of what he said in private. We you know, my guess is, historians being what they are, we will find out, you know, maybe after we're both dead. I don't know. The other thing is, I think about the moment when actually you and I first met, which was just before the first Gulf War, when Colin Powell was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And unlike many people who have a very, very warm and high regard for Powell, I don't. And one of the reasons why I don't is I think he consistently stepped over the mark in terms of being a public figure, shaping perceptions of what the war is all about, what are reasonable limits, what are unreasonable limits. I don't think he actually gave very good military advice to the George H.W. Bush administration. I think, you know, the fact is that we had such incredible overmatch that it didn't matter. And I would rather not have that kind of chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, honestly.
Well, I completely agree with that. And, you know, I think it's going to be interesting how history treats General Powell, because I think as people go back and look at the record, particularly once I think a lot of records start to be declassified, and more now is being declassified on the Bush 41 administration, I think some of this is going to become more evident. I mean, the fact that he was consistently talking to and leaking to Bob Woodward about what, you know, what the course of policy should be in the run-up to Desert Storm, at variance with what the president was pursuing, I think is going to not look good and not stand, you know, well in his, in his case before history. So I mean, I agree with you that the chairman should not be playing politics and should not be shading, you know, shouldn't be addressing the political objective of a military activity. I think the issue becomes more, is he telling the president, and we just, as you say, don't know the answer to this, that if we, you know, if we hit X number of targets, we will have achieved, you know, our strategic objective. That's, I think, the question.
And I think, you know, that is, unfortunately, having had a lot of experience with the U.S. Air Force, I think that is the natural predisposition of of pilots in my experience is to think of victory in terms of working your way through a target deck. And once you work your way through the target deck, you've won.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Listen, before we go to the big Iran question that I wanted to ask you, there was another piece which got into the papers, including the Times, but also the Post and others, which I thought we might discuss briefly because I'm sure many of our listeners and viewers have seen it. And it was one which said, okay, intelligence report comes out, shows the Iranians can access 30 of their 33 missile sites, which then gets translated effectively into this thing is a failure. And I had some strong reactions to that, but I think in addition to whatever the strong reactions are, I think it might be of interest and even of use to our viewers and listeners if we talk about how do you read something like that? I mean, how should you interpret something like that when it pops up on your iPad or for those people who are still looking at print, you read it in the newspaper. I mean, there are probably a few people our age and older who actually remember things called newspapers. So do you want to start off?
If you can afford to buy one.
Yeah, well, there's that too. Do you want to start off? And I've got some thoughts on it too, obviously.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, this is a part of a number of leaks that have come out of the intelligence community that have basically suggested that that the campaign, for instance, against Iran's missile launch and missile inventory capabilities has maybe not been quite as successful as advertised. The 30 out of 33 launch points, I think, was for anti-ship cruise missiles along the Persian Gulf. And, you know, I know you will make all the appropriate critical points about the intelligence community has a tendency to, you know, focus on the things that they can measure as opposed to, you know, what might actually be the important things. So I think there's that. And there was already pushback today. Brad Cooper testifying in Congress today said a lot of these numbers, 70%, are wrong. He believes that, you know, the numbers are better. For instance, he was saying we've wiped out 90% of Iran's 8,000 mines. So I guess, you know, there are a couple of points here. One, there are always deficient. First of all, assessments are assessments. They're not fact. You know, some of our colleagues in the intelligence community, not all, some have the view that only intelligence, you know, community professionals who are high priests can look at, you know, the information and, you know, reach their own, and they reach conclusions. And once they've reached the conclusion, it's the right conclusion. And, you know, my view as a consumer always was, yeah, I'm interested in your assessment, but I really want to see the raw intelligence. I want to see the, you know, photo intelligence. I want to see the SIGINT. I want to see the this, the that. And then I want to see if I, you know, agree with your assessment, because I might weigh the evidence differently than you do. I might put more emphasis. I might put more emphasis, for instance, on human intelligence than I do on you know, what you've gotten from overhead imagery, or vice versa. You know, depending on the quality of the sourcing and what have you. So, you know, you once wrote a terrific book, Supreme Command, about the importance of political leaders interrogating military officers about military plans in war, and not just assume that the military professionals know what they're doing, which I think is right. And I think the same is true of intelligence. You know, policymakers need to interrogate the intelligence. They need to really get down into it. You know, one of the charges against the late Dick Cheney was that he was trying to manipulate intelligence. And from years of working with him, I know that the answer was he wasn't trying to manipulate the intelligence. He was trying to understand the intelligence. And he read it more closely, I think, than a lot of analysts did in terms of getting into the raw intelligence and looking at it himself and then asking him, well, why do you prefer this piece of intelligence over that? Because it's never clear cut. You know, you're trying to take disparate pieces. You know, it's not that different from being an ancient historian. You know, you have a coin, you've got an inscription, you've got a couple of passages from Thucydides, who we will return to later in the show. And then you try and interpret what that means. And the same is true of intelligence, honestly. So, you know, there's that element to it. There is also the element, though, that our military does tend to overestimate what it's accomplished for all the reasons you were talking about. They tend to look at war as inputs rather than outputs. And so when Admiral Cooper says we've destroyed 90% of Iran's 8,000 mines, I would point out that, number one, that 8,000 number, which he used in public, which I had heard privately a few weeks ago, is actually a little bit higher than the 6,000 number that they were publicly carrying a while ago. And that even, you know, if you wipe out 90% of 8,000 mines, that leaves the Iranians with 800 mines, which is, you know, since they don't even have to lay a mine to actually have a impact in the Gulf, they just have to suggest that they have laid a mine. 800 is a lot.
So I agree with all that. I guess I would add, this is really, again, for the benefit of people who don't, haven't marinated in this stuff over a period of years. I think there are four big questions you should always ask. The first question is, qui bono? Who benefits from this leak? Sometimes it can be the administration. Sometimes it could be an opponent. Sometimes it can be a piece of the bureaucracy. It could be the intelligence community itself. But the point is, it is, in my experience at least, it is never the case that some intrepid reporter, you know, somehow managed to infiltrate themselves into the old executive office building, you know, rummage through the safes and pick something out and exfiltrate himself and then publish it. Somebody's leaking something for a reason to make a point. And by definition, this is a tiny, whatever report you're citing, it's a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of the stuff that comes in over the transom. I mean, I tried to be selective when I was reading intelligence, but I was always looking at every morning about a 2 or 3 inch stack of paper. You were probably reading even more. And that was after being selective and after having aides go through stuff and screen it. So that's really the first thing you have to say. Why this particular piece now? I think the second question you want to ask is, the source, to the extent you know the source of the leak, or to put it differently, did the reporter see the whole intelligence document? Or are they merely relying on hearsay from somebody who calls them up and says, you know what, this report says X, Y, and Z? Again, my experience, reporters don't actually want to be caught with highly classified material in their possession, because then they have legal problems. So I think that's the second thing. You know, how do you know this is actually an accurate representation of what the report has to say? Third thing is the common sense test. And this really goes more to the interpretation. So, you know, from that intelligence report, a lot of people extrapolated into, see, this didn't do anything. The first common sense thing you should say, wait a second. So what you're telling me is that after 13,000 strikes by the U.S. Air Force, and a comparable number, maybe even more, by the Israelis, so let's say 26, 27,000 strikes by the two best air forces in the world, using the most advanced munitions in the world, informed by excellent intelligence, as far as we know, didn't really do much? Maybe. I mean, I suppose in some alternate universe, that's possible, but it just seems to me there's a common sense test which you should always apply to the question, how does that add up? The final thing is simply parsing the words. So in this particular case, you know, that when the line that got quoted is that the Iranians have access to 30 of 33 sites. That may just mean you can walk inside a door, that they cleared away the rubble and you can walk inside the door. Doesn't mean that the stuff inside works. You know, doesn't mean that the operators who you need to, you know, maintain and launch these things are still alive, and so on and so forth. So it's not, you know, that I think you should disbelieve any of these reports or ignore them, and you can't if you're reading the news. But it does seem to me you've got to be really, really careful and skeptical, and apply that kind of critical eye that you're absolutely right. Dick Cheney did, and I will say to their credit, I've known in fact, I think it was John McLaughlin, former deputy director of CIA and a very good friend, who said, you know, people did not object to briefing Cheney; they liked it. I mean, the you know, the frontline analysts liked somebody who's going to ask a lot of questions and, you know, really try to get to the bottom of things and really interact with them. You know, what they hate is being ignored.
Yeah, and I think his PDB briefers would heartily, you know, second that. Look, I agree with that. I guess what I would say is, you know, the truth is out there somewhere, you know, in between all of this.
Yeah.
I mean, the one thing I will say is I don't think our intelligence community, you know, colleagues make stuff up out of whole cloth. And I think, for instance, on the 30 of 33, you know, cruise missile sites along the coast of the Gulf, maybe it's 30 out of 33, maybe it's 15, who knows? I mean, the numbers. But what I would say is, what the assessment kind of represents is there's enough uncertainty about how much they have that it clearly has affected the U.S. Navy's willingness to go in there. I mean, they've only gone in there in a very limited way after using some classified capabilities to clear out, you know, some of the mines. They've shown themselves to be very sensitive to the cruise missile threat. I'm not begrudging them that. I mean, I don't think you should, randomly put a billion-dollar DDG, you know, guided missile destroyer into a situation where it could be damaged or destroyed with loss of life and materiel. So, you know, I think it's a very complicated picture. And I will say, the one thing that I have taken away, and this is, you know, kind of my own, I've been surprised at how resilient the regime has shown itself to be, both militarily and politically. And the fact that during this ceasefire, they're clearly concerned about public, opposition, and they've had a pretty massive presence, you know, in the streets and they've had a lot of big showy demonstrations of, you know, regime support. But I mean, I would not have predicted that they have, you know, would be both in terms of able to inflict damage, you know, on neighbors in the Gulf and politically survive this. You know, I wouldn't have predicted that they would be where they are. Now, how long that will last, you know, once this ends, when they have to get back to managing the country and being responsible for water shortages and food shortages and electricity shortages, that's a different question. But, you know, I can get a sense of where some of what you're talking about is coming from, because there, I'm sure, were intelligence reports that suggested the regime is stronger than you think before the fact. And people now in the intelligence community want to make the point, we told you so, which they're frequently quite good at, as my former boss Bob Gates once told me.
And in a way, that gets to the cui bono part of it. My wife and I just saw an old episode of Law and Order, which had a lot of, you know, the cops telling the prosecutors, I told you so. I did want us, I wish we had a lot more time today, but let me I wanted to share an email that we got from a listener. We do pay attention to whatever you write to either of us or both of us. And this is from David in Teaneck. And I think he deserves an answer. So I'm going to read the whole email. Gentlemen, I've enjoyed listening to Shield of the Republic for around the past 18 months. Your commentaries and interviews are very enlightening and informative. They certainly are, David. I have a question for you both, though, and ask if you devote an edition of Shield of the Republic to it. Let's say that by some miracle, Trump and his toadies are thrown out of office, and the new president, who we assume to be in the mold of either a Mitt Romney or Barack Obama, it doesn't matter which, called you two to the White House and asked, what should the United States do with Iran? What concrete operational advice would you give him? This layman fears that there's no easy out. The thought of declaring ourselves the winner and leaving, which I imagine some might counsel, seems catastrophic to me. So what should we do? It seems like the Trump plan, if it can be called a plan, is to hope that if we continue with the status quo, the Iranian economy will become so bad that they have to come to terms with us. But I'm not convinced that the Iranians would do that. Nor am I convinced that there would be a revolution with a new leader who would turn things around. So what should we do? I'd love to hear your thoughts. Well, that was clearly directed at you, Eric.
Yeah, thanks.
So answer, David, would you?
Yeah, I mean, it's a hard, you know, it's a hard question in part because you're asking someone to say, okay, you know, I'm in the middle of something that's pretty messy, and how do I, you know, how do we clean up the mess? I think one thing that this has demonstrated, what's happened in the last, you know, 10 weeks now, is that in the end of the day, there is no solution to the problem that Iran has presented to the region that doesn't involve, you know, a change in the regime. And that doesn't mean the United States can do that unilaterally by, you know, marching in with an invasion. I don't, you know, nobody, I think, well, maybe not nobody, but I don't think many people who have advocated regime change, certainly not me, have advocated doing it at the point of a gun. But what's been missing, I think, going back 40 years is any kind of serious effort to develop, you know, an alternative leadership that might be able to capitalize on the popular you know, antipathy to the, you know, theocratic regime. And so I think we have to think about this, you know, in the long run. And I guess my advice to the president would be there are two things. One, you have to start now a long-term campaign to undermine this regime by aiding Iranian civilians in a way that allows them to ultimately do what has happened multiple times in the Iranian past, in 1906, in the 20s, in the 1950s, and in the late 1970s, which is take their country into their own hands and determine, you know, a change in leadership. And that means, you know, not just providing, you know, small arms to Iranians who might be willing to take up arms against the regime, as we did with the Contras in, you know, in Nicaragua, but also allowing people to giving people the means to communicate with each other and the outside world, Starlink terminals, you know, cell phones that are secure that they can communicate with one another internally, supporting groups in trade unions, like particularly the oil workers, teachers that have been transport workers who have been politically active in the past, who could play a role, and developing a core of leadership so that, you know, that there are people who could actually take over from, you know, the current crowd. That's one. The other is that I don't think that we can allow Iran to have a chokehold over the international economy and the Gulf. And so we have to find some way to do that. And that probably will require the president of the United States, if not this one, then another one, saying we're going to do this and there's going to be loss of life. There's every prospect that we're going to lose a couple of ships. There's every prospect that we're going to lose some lives. But, you know, we can't allow this group of people in this country to do this, and we're going to have to open perhaps the strait by force if we can't reach some kind of reasonable accommodation. I don't see any sign right now that Iran thinks that they have to make a reasonable accommodation.
So I would agree with all that. I guess my response would begin this way by saying, first, David, I think one has to be careful who one is giving advice to. And you know, so you can't, you have to have at least some sort of sense that the kind of thing that you're advising is something that they're actually capable of implementing. But let's stipulate that that's the case. So you know, I feel very comfortable with, say, with Mitt Romney, who both Eric and I knew, and on whose campaign, actually, presidential campaign, we worked, would be somebody who you could kind of say what I'm about to say. I would say here are the kind of the main assumptions you have to have going in. One is that this will be a long conflict, as Eric says, as long as this regime is around. And say, I would probably say to him, Mr. President, understand this war is one campaign. This is not a separate war. This is a campaign in a much longer war that's been going on since the early 80s. It has taken different forms. By the way, it's included lots and lots of attacks on American personnel throughout the Gulf and even beyond. So this is how you have to understand what we're dealing with. Secondly, I think your two immediate objectives are, first, exactly what Eric said. We have to have the Straits of Hormuz open. The Iranians cannot be allowed to charge tolls or anything like that. And the second thing is, obviously, you can't let them have a nuclear weapon. That probably means that there will be repeated doses of military action. And as Eric said, that may require the use of force. I would then say the most important thing, though, that you need to do really right away is begin explaining to the American people why this matters and reaching out to our allies in the Gulf, in Europe, in Asia, and bring them on. I mean, as Eric and I have been saying all along, one of the sort of appalling mishandling of all this by the Trump administration is that there's just been no effort to prepare either the American public or any of our allies. And that's been really problematic. This does need to be a much larger effort. The final thing I would say, and this, my guess is people are in effect already working on, you need to find technical solutions as best you can to the kinds of threats that the Iranians pose. And that's where people like the Ukrainians come in. But there's a lot of technology now that's being developed to deal with drones and ballistic missiles, and we should take full advantage of it. But I think the beginning of wisdom on this one is, unfortunately, you're going to have to assume this is going to go on for a while. We're going to need a supportive public, and we're going to need supportive allies, which at the moment we don't really have. So I hope that answers the question, David, as best we can.
Yeah, it helps, I would say, if you stop insulting your allies. I mean, that's, you know.
Yeah, that would be, and probably not a good idea to say, oh, I don't care about the financial impact on the American people of any of this.
Yeah, I don't know that we're going to get into this because we don't have time. We talked about it last week, which was the cancellation of the brigade combat team going to Germany. Arguably, you could understand that as Trump punishing, you know, Mertz for saying something bad, but he just pulled the plug on a deployment to Poland. And the Poles, by any measure, have been a, quote, good ally. I mean, you know, so anyway.
Yeah. No, there's a lot of damage to be undone. So speaking of Trump, we've had a summit with Xi Jinping and Donald Trump. And I'll put my cards right on the table. I have no idea what happened, and I don't really make anything of it other than there were a bunch of greedy chief executives looking for juicy deals in China. That's a story that's actually, you know, let's say a century and a half old. You know, what was the old line? If you could get everybody in China to add 1 inch to their shirt tails, you'd keep the mills of Lancaster spinning for 50 years, there was something like that, that the British used to say. But you know, you might want to elaborate on this, given your diplomatic expertise, Eric. The fact that you had two communiques, which were quite different, one Chinese, one American, that's probably the most significant part of all this. You want to just speak to that a little bit?
Well, first, there was no agreed joint statement. At least they haven't released one so far. Maybe they're working on one. I don't know. The statements you're referring to were, I think, technically not really communiques, but actually readouts by each side of what had happened. And the readouts actually came before the final meeting. So I don't know that they're, you know, even authoritative from that point of view. What was striking to me about the Chinese readout was quite detailed, but opaque. I mean, in the sense that it was like a long laundry list of subjects covered. But on the Middle East, which the Secretary of State indicated on the way over to China was going to be a kind of major ask of the Chinese, the Chinese statement said the two sides exchanged views. The U.S. statement, which was put out in a post, you know, a Twitter post by or X post by the White House, said, you know, President Xi agreed with us and President Trump that the strait should be open and there should be no tolls and that, you know, Iran should never have a nuclear weapon. I mean, as if these were big concessions by the Chinese. These are traditional Chinese positions that they are just repeating. And the president then went on Sean Hannity and said that, oh, yeah, Xi says he wants to help. I hope he can help. And I'm not quite sure what to make of that, you know, in light of these, you know, the sort of laconic Chinese, you know, account of what happened and the more, you know, enthusiastic White House readout. My inclination is to believe that China is going to pay lip service to all these things that we, quote, agree on, but, you know, quite happy to, you know, allow the U.S., you know, to continue to, you know, suffer, you know, the incomplete nature of this, you know, military engagement and with no outcome. In particular, the drawdown of, you know, high-end munitions, which I'm sure they're quite happy to see. Interestingly, Trump told Sean Hannity, oh, yeah, Xi told me he won't sell stuff to the Iranians, won't sell military equipment to the Iranians. And the president seems to think this is some great, you know, again, concession he's won from Xi. I just point out that when, you know, Barack Obama raised with Xi the militarization of islands in the South China Sea, Xi promised him he wouldn't do it and then went ahead and did it. So whatever he promised Trump, and we know from reporting in the New York Times, again, coming from the intelligence community, that, you know, the Chinese are looking for third-party cutouts to send stuff to Iran so that they have deniability. So, you know, everything to me suggests they're going to continue to try and make our predicament as bad as possible while perhaps paying lip service to helping. And on the businessmen and business deals, I mean, so far, nothing announced other than 200 jets to Boeing, which sent Boeing stock tumbling because people had anticipated, you know, something like 400, which is kind of what the Europeans have gotten in earlier visits to Beijing. So, you know, although the president, of course, touting this as the greatest summit ever, that the only thing Americans are talking about at home, although you and I are the only ones I've heard talk about it at all. But, you know, other than that, I'll wrap up and say, you know, there was a lot of discussion that Xi raised Taiwan with the president and referred to the Thucydides trap, which is a notion put forward by Harvard professor Graham Allison that U.S. and China are trapped in the same kind of strategic competition that Athens and Sparta were in the ancient world, which gave rise to the Peloponnesian War. And we got to make sure that this terrible and avoidable tragedy could be avoided. My question is, do you think Trump has any clue who Thucydides was? And could he tell you which of the two parties to the Peloponnesian War were?
Okay, so I mean, you had to use the phrase Thucydides trap, knowing I think that it has the effect on me that it For those who are
Niagara Falls,
exactly. If you're a connoisseur of the Three Stooges, you will know the Niagara Falls skit. If you don't, go on YouTube and look it up. Now, I mean, the Thucydides trap is such a stupid idea because one of the things that Thucydides says is that, you know, one of the deeper causes of the Peloponnesian War is the rise of Athenian power and the fear that that aroused in Sparta. But there are so many ways in which it doesn't apply at all. Because first, people are treated as, well, this is about the dynamics of international politics. Actually, what Thucydides describes is a contest between a rising democratic power, and which has actually already had an empire, by the way, and Sparta, which is an intensely conservative place. So that's, you know, that's one part of this. That I think is ridiculous. And in fact, you know, Thucydides thinks domestic politics is tremendously important. And so the idea that the United States is Sparta, where they did things like, you know, kill all the Helots, and I mean, the whole thing is just, and you know, it was a very small place. You had only, you know, 2,000 Spartiates or something like that. Instead of being a, you know, country of hundreds of million people that has better demographics than China. China's not a rising democracy. It's just stupid, and people should stop it. So we can move on to other things. I'll just say on the summit, as I confessed to you in the green room, with Trump, maybe, and you know, you can blame me for this, I'm increasingly succumbing to the soft bigotry of low expectations, which in this case means if he didn't go there and come back and say, I've got this amazing deal, all we have to do is betray Taiwan and he'll open the Straits of Taiwan, the Straits of Hormuz. And if we betray Ukraine as well, we'll get, you know, the most incredible business deals, including another, you know, big airplane for me to fly around in or something like that. The truth is he actually didn't do any of those things. And as far as we know,
yeah.
Like I said, it is the soft bigotry of low expectations. You know, what would be interesting if you could get inside his head is whether he really thinks that the Chinese have leverage and he does not, or whether he thinks that he has leverage and they don't, or what's probably more likely, that he views them as sort of peers. The one of the newspapers today, I think it was the Post, make a big deal and said, wow, you're treating the Chinese as a peer. Yeah. You know, they've got a GDP that's, what, 60% the size of ours, maybe bigger. They've got a bigger manufacturing establishment. They, you know, they're a big, deep civilization. They're a lot more formidable in many respects than the Russians. Yeah, we should be treating them as a peer. I don't view that as, you know, this is you know, Trump rolling over and caving. I think it's kind of a recognition of reality. So I don't know. We'll see. Maybe another shoe will drop. We're running out of time. The other thing that happened in the middle of all this, really interesting, was John Ratcliffe, the director of the CIA, flew to Cuba, which has literally run out of oil. So the streets are dark. There's massive rioting. And of course, you usually send the director of the CIA to deal with countries you don't really have diplomatic relations with, but you want to convey a message. I have been hearing from friends, some journalists in particular, that the administration really does intend to go after the Cuban regime. This is particularly high priority for Marco Rubio. And that this may actually happen. Now, in what way, I don't know. I'm curious what you think. I will say I would not have expected that the administration would have been able to bring the Cuban government to its knees in this way. But maybe I'm wrong. What do you think?
I mean, clearly the cutoff of oil from Venezuela has had a catastrophic effect. I mean, Cuba was in bad shape to begin with. I mean, it was not in, you know, anybody in great shape anyhow. I mean, just before we came on, you know, there were stories breaking that the Justice Department may be about to indict Raul Castro for the role he played as Minister of Defense 30-odd years ago in the shootdown of the Brothers to the Rescue aircraft that came from Florida. So I don't, you know, yeah, I mean, by all accounts, you see that Trump is, quote unquote, getting bored with Iran and wants to move on to Cuba. He said, we're going to have a takeover of Cuba. It's going to be kind of a friendly takeover, he said. I mean, he's now suggesting Venezuela should be the 51st state. And he's, you know, because Venezuela loves Trump, he says, and he's done a Truth Social post with the American flag superimposed on Venezuela. Maybe it'd be a foot race to see whether Venezuela or Cuba becomes the 51st state under Trump. Although
they have to wait behind Canada and Greenland.
And it's kind of ironic that, you know, he lifted temporary protective status for Venezuelans, but now he wants to make them citizens. So, you know, I'm sure Stephen Miller is having trouble keeping up with all of this anyway. Look, I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, be careful what you wish for, you know, because you might get it. You know, this was when Germany was unified in 1990, you know, West Germany suddenly had to take on enormous cost of, you know, bringing East Germany into the nation. And, you know, if we knock over the regime in Cuba and don't want to have a flight of Cubans, you know, like the Mariel boatlift into the southeastern United States, then we're going to own it, you know, and we're going to have to, you know, do something to help resuscitate the place. I'm just not sure what's coming.
I'm going to tell you what's coming.
Trump casinos in Havana, right?
Trump casinos in Havana and Trump branded Cuban cigars.
And
you personally might not object to that being a cigar connoisseur.
I will not buy a Trump branded Cuban cigars. And you know that my own view is that Cuban cigars are not all that they're cracked up to be, but that's a subject for another show. I do, before we go off, we have been long today, but that's okay. I did write something else this week in addition to...
Yeah, I was going to raise that.
Lionizing the Reagan administration. Last week at a defense expo, the Turkish government unveiled a purported intercontinental ballistic missile, the Yildirim Han missile. This is a missile that has on one side the signature of Kemal Ataturk, and on the other side, the Tura, the seal of Sultan Bayezid I, who basically presided over the reduction of Anatolia to Ottoman suzerainty and besieged Constantinople, but failed to reduce the city. And then ultimately was taken prisoner by Tamerlane and finished out his years as a prison. Hard to know what to make of the symbolism there, although it does echo the sort of Islamo-nationalism of the Erdogan regime over the last 25 years. But what possible use on earth could a country like Turkey, which has, as a NATO member, is a beneficiary of the U.S. security guarantee, what use do they possibly have for an ICBM?
I was going to ask you. I mean, the question is, who is it aimed at and what would they put on the top of it? Because an ICBM really only makes sense if you're going to put a nuclear weapon on it. But also, who do you think it's aimed at?
Well, there was a video that I guess was a heuristic device for the people who produced this, which showed it attacking the U.S., although its assessed range – first of all, the thing's never been tested. So it's not – you know, it's a – what they put on display was a prototype, but it's never literally had an engine test, much less a flight test. So – you know, could be aimed at us, although that seems a little odd. The video got pulled, by the way, and the defense minister said, I don't know anything about that. It was AI generated, of course. You know, Israel, obviously, is a, you know, potential competitor. You know, a lot of competition between Israel and Turkey for influence in Syria since the Assad regime collapsed, and more broadly in the region, of course. Although you don't need a 6,000-kilometer, you know, range missile to go after Israel. This thing does have, by the way, a pretty hefty 6,000-kilogram warhead, allegedly, conventional. But it does raise a question of, you know, does Turkey at some point, some level, harbor nuclear, you know, aspirations, even though they're a signatory of the NPT? I take it myself as a symbol of the lowering barriers in general to nations getting ballistic missile technology, which has spread enormously and continues to spread. The fact that, you know, they've been used promiscuously in the war between Ukraine and Russia and in the wars that have followed in the Middle East since October 7th, 2023. And because U.S. security guarantees have become less reliable. And in that sense, I think it's really symbolic of the sort of more disordered world we're moving into. And for all of the jeremiads against globalism and, you know, recriminations about the liberal international order, does make me think Americans may come to look back on that as, you know, the halcyon days compared to where we're headed.
I couldn't agree with you more. Well, we really covered a lot today. We didn't talk about Russia-Ukraine, where the, you know, on the one hand, Putin is saying this war is coming to a close, and then he kind of increases his demands to all of the Donbass, which he's not going to get, to all kinds of interesting things happening in Central Asia and the Caucasus. And as one friend put it, the great game starting all over again, but this time in Africa, where there are all kinds of interesting things afoot. So plenty of stuff for us to discuss on future episodes of Shield of the Republic, but I think probably that's enough for one day.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.